is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, last night, around 10:40 Eastern time, I got whisked off by limousine to the MSNBC studios here in Washington, D.C., and was on Lawrence O'Donnell's show. It's been a couple of years since I've talked with Lawrence. You know, he's a good guy, and it was nice being on his show last night. Thank you, Lawrence. But anyhow, the point is, the discussion was basically, should Elizabeth Warren endorse Bernie Sanders? And I'm saying, yes, she should, because they share issues right down the board. And Casey Hunt made a really interesting point. I was on a panel with Casey Hunt and David Axelrod and David Corn. And Casey Hunt's insight, I thought it was particularly insightful. She was like, you know, Elizabeth Warren wants to be a senator and wants to have power and authority in the Senate. The Clintons have long memories, and they punish their enemies and help their friends. So if Elizabeth Warren endorses anybody before the primary who is other than Hillary Clinton, a lot of opportunities for her, if Hillary Clinton becomes president, may close. A lot of doors may close. And this is true not, of course, just of Elizabeth Warren. I mean, Cory Booker yesterday endorsed Hillary Clinton, and, you know, you can question his motives. I think that Hillary Clinton is a good and viable candidate. I think Bernie Sanders is better, but, you know, they're both fine with me, you know, given what we have. For that matter, I don't know that much about, but I'm not all offended by Martin O'Malley. We've been, apparently, I think Sean has been talking to his people about getting him on the program and taking calls from you. That would be interesting. But in any case, the point that I made last night that I think was the most important point is that not only can Bernie win the Democratic primary, I believe he can win the White House, and that if he does so, well, here's a little clip of the conversation.
Tom Hartman, would you put it as a matter of political integrity that Elizabeth Warren should endorse Bernie Sanders, that he is the closest representation of her views in this campaign?
Well, yeah, I understand the political calculus that David was talking about and don't disagree with that. But, yeah, I think so. I mean, basically, they're saying the same things. They're saying it's time to bring transparency, openness, integrity back to the political process and get money out of the political process, overturn Citizens United, put the middle class back together, strengthen Social Security. These are solid issues. These are genuinely solid issues. And I think that Bernie Sanders, and I say this, I wouldn't, you know, for a long time I didn't actually think this, and now I'm absolutely convinced of it. He has the potential to be the next FDR.
There you go. So, and the reason why, I mean, you know, if you look at Bernie's positions, basically it's just a complete repudiation of Reaganomics and taking us back to the economic and social system that we had from the 1930s until the 1970s, the end of the 70s, until 1981 when Reagan took office, which was Keynesian economics, for lack of a better word. The government was the employer of last resort. The government provided health care, you know, Medicaid, then Medicare, or Medicare, then Medicaid. The government provided an old age pension program and also one third of Social Security as disability benefits for those who are unable to work. It, you know, just as a starting point, I mean, in 35, Bernie passed, or maybe it was 33, Bernie passed Glass-Steagall. Excuse me, not Bernie, FDR passed Glass-Steagall. And Bernie is saying, hey, let's bring back Glass-Steagall. In 35, it was the Wagner Act. You know, they legalized unions. And Bernie is like, you know, let's stop this Republican trend of criminalizing unions, essentially, or destroying them. And we are, I think, later on today going to be having a discussion about that. Bernie said, you know, let's go back to supporting unions. I mean, even Eisenhower ran in 56 on a campaign of how much union membership had increased during his presidency. I mean, it's, of course, you know, Republicans these days would say Eisenhower wasn't actually a Republican. He certainly wasn't a Republican by the standards of today's party. He was not a Fox so-called news Republican. In fact, he laughed at people like that. He said their numbers are stupid and they are wrong. Excuse me, their numbers are small and they are stupid. That was the phrase in his letter to his brother Edgar. So, anyhow, do you think that Bernie Sanders could be the next FDR? Or for that matter, is it possible that Hillary Clinton could be the next FDR? You know, is it possible that there's enough of a movement in the United States? And I'm seeing this both on the left and the right. And I'm guessing that, you know, Bernie's, you know, I've talked often about insiders and outsiders. And I didn't want to get into it last night on TV because I was sitting there with a couple of insiders who might have taken offense. And it wasn't all that relevant anyway. But basically, this city is not divided into left-right. It's divided into insiders-outsiders. And, you know, like on the Republican Party, you got outsiders. Basically, Rand Paul has become an outsider. And in the Democratic Party, you've got, well, I think Nancy Pelosi recently said that Elizabeth Warren doesn't speak for the Democratic Party. And, you know, so Nancy Pelosi is the ultimate insider, right, former Speaker of the House. And Elizabeth Warren is apparently viewed as an outsider. And I think this is going to be an outsider election. I really do. And this is something that the Republican Party is struggling with. Jeb Bush is the ultimate insider. He's the one that the Wall Street wants. He's safe. He's predictable. He'll always be in favor of business. He can bring along, you know, he control and bring along, you know, the social conservatives by talking about abortion and talking about women's issues or whatever, you know, in ways that satisfy the right wing base. Although he's rather moderate on immigration, and you know, so in any case, the Republican Party, it appears to me, Donald Trump is the ultimate outsider, and he's the number two in all the polls right now. He's number two in the Republican race. I think that, by the way, is not so much that he's an outsider, although I think that's a big piece of it, because no insiders are calling for this. I think it's because Donald Trump is saying our trade policies suck and need to be completely rebooted from the ground up. And he's right. But that will not get covered in the press. He keeps saying it, but then the commentary goes off in completely different directions. They never have commentary about Trump's comments on trade. Never. Because the networks are part of the cabal of big transnational corporations that are going to benefit from shipping more American jobs overseas and further eviscerating the American middle class to the benefit of the CEOs and the banksters. So, anyhow, if I look at the accomplishments of the New Deal over and over and over again, I see over and over and over again Bernie Sanders' platform. It just seems that straightforward. By the way, Macy has dumped Donald Trump. And black churches are burning. This is the hashtag that's trending is who is burning black churches. And here's some of the tweets. After Charleston, black people were begged to remain nonviolent. Then white racists torches seven of their churches. The same people who talked on end about a CVS being burnt down remain silent as black churches burn repeatedly. I've seen dumpsters set on fire and riots got more news coverage than these churches. The silent consent of white Christians for the epidemic of terrorist attacks on black churches speaks volumes. I woke up in 2015. From the looks of it, I'll be going to sleep in 1963. We saw pictures of the CVS burning. Now, this was, you know, the pharmacy that was burned by black people, right? We saw pictures of the CVS burning from every angle, including helicopter shots, for weeks. Black churches? Crickets. I've not seen any footage. I'm guessing it may be out there. I don't watch television that much, but there's a lot in the news. I got more right after the break, and then we'll get to you. It's Anything Goes Summer.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In the next hour, in the second hour, Dar Jamail is going to be with us. Are humans now an endangered species? In our third hour, Tim Sandifer is going to talk about why unions shouldn't exist in the public sector. And welcome back. Jim in Lockport, Illinois. Hey, Jim, what's up? Thanks for watching.
How are you, TV. Tom?
I'm fine. What's up?
It was nice to see you in high def last night.
Yeah, it's quite a difference, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, a while back you would ask me, actually you proposed a question to the public on, you know, how do we get the word of Bernie out there? And I told you the best thing to do is to have Bernie go out there and just speak. And he's doing that. And he's knocking on Hillary's doorstep big time. So,
they're going to, you know, he's got a gig tonight in Madison, Wisconsin. That's going to, you know, they can only seat 10,000 people. And as of yesterday afternoon, 9,500 people had RSVP'd. Now, you're going to probably have a certain amount of breakage, it's called, no shows. So they will probably take, you know, 10,500 or 11,000 RSVPs. But I have a feeling that, you know, they're going to end up with 15,000, 20,000 people who want to be there.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, you know, I'd love to get them here to Illinois, though. You know, we got a large Latino community here in the Lockport, Joliet area.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important demographic to hit. Just to give you an idea, Tom, every time I talk to a Latino brother or sister, I tell them how important it is to get out and vote. And if they expect immigration reform, they're the ones that have to give the president the tools to do the job.
Right.
I think they miss that point sometimes. They put a lot of onus on the president that he can do so much. But we got to get him out there, and hopefully we can do that. And if Bernie gets out there and talks, I still say truth and honesty will prevail over dollars and cents any day of the week.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Jim. And the question ultimately that has to be answered is you can draw big crowds. You can be, you know, an overnight sensation, as it were. Will you have staying power? And I believe that because Bernie is not campaigning on his personality, if anything, it's the opposite, right? I mean, he's not, you know, the blow-dried, you know, TV-perfect John F. Kennedy candidate. You know, he's a guy in his 70s with the rumpled suit and hair that keeps flying up in the air. He's not running on his personality. He's running on the issues. And the issues are dead center for the majority of Americans. And those issues are not being addressed because our Congress is owned by a group of billionaires and transnational corporations. In fact, I'm going to get into that when we come back from the break. You know, exactly who got how much money to push through the fast track. And you know, Bernie is one of the few guys in Congress that you can say, you know, yeah, I got some money from some unions, and that's about it. You know, the rest of it's independent donors. And unions are democracies. And they represent working people. So I got no problem with him being supported by unions. And, you know, we'll see where it goes. We'll see where this goes. I suggested to somebody on his staff that they should come to Chicago. I said, you know, people in Chicago have been listening to Brunch with Bernie for 10 years now on this program. And, you know, but, you know, I'm not an advisor to the campaign. They don't take my suggestions. Actually, I think that's the first time I've actually offered a suggestion through all this time. But Jim, you know, go over to BernieSanders.com and sign up, and you know, offer if you offer to help set it up, they may come for it. What do you think?
You have a good day, Tom.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jim. You too. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. I suppose, in a way, it's not surprising that the big television networks, owned by white people, run by white people, staffed largely by white people, are not doing the 24/7, you know, helicopter shots of burning black churches, whereas they did of the burning CVS in Baltimore. But it's worth pointing out the hashtag Who is Burning Black Churches. This is important stuff. And let's not, and while we're at it, let's not forget the fate of our Native American brothers and sisters. I don't have the printout of this. I should have printed it this morning, but I saw this story about a Native American young man, 25 years old, locked in a jail cell for 2 weeks over a fine he had failed to pay, and he died of dehydration. They refused to give him water. Dead. And pretty much nobody is speaking for the Native Americans. And it would be great to see a coalition put together between Native Americans and African Americans who have both been the victims of 400 years of white supremacist manifest destiny thinking on the part of white people. So, you know, we'll see where that goes. J. Barry Hill over at Democratic Underground, here's what happens when clerks refuse. This is if you're a gay couple and you go in to get your marriage license, and the clerk says, no, I'm not going to do it for you. I'm sorry, I object. That you have been deprived of your rights under the law. And the law that's relevant is 42 U.S.C. 1983, which says every person who, under color of any statute or ordinance, regulation, custom, or usage of any state or territory or the District of Columbia, in other words, anybody who works for the government, subjects or causes to be subjected any citizen of the United States or other person within the jurisdiction thereof to the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured by the Constitution and laws, shall be liable to the party injured in the action at law, suit in equity, and other proper proceeding for redress. In other words, you can sue that clerk personally. And not only that, you can sue for compensatory damages, you can sue for punitive damages, and you can sue for your attorney's fees. So all you do, if a clerk, you know, this, let me just tell the, and if you have any friends who are gay and who are thinking about getting married, pass this along. If a clerk anywhere in the country, and we just saw this happen yesterday in Texas, you know, a clerk said on Friday, clerk said, no, I'm not going to give you a marriage license. On Monday morning, that clerk was served with a lawsuit, and Monday afternoon, the clerk resigned. Right? That was it. Just backed off. Yeah, clerk folded on Monday. There you go. So you fill in the relevant names, he writes, dates and places in a form complaint, pay your $300 filing fee, which will come back to you in your prize package when you win the lawsuit, along with the form motion for emergency injunctive relief, and serve it on the clerk. It's very interesting, very simple. And more people, I think, are going to start doing this. It's today's Wednesday. I've been thinking it was Friday ever since I woke up this morning. I was like, yeah, oh, wow, it's Friday, and Friday we've got, it's Thursday, and Friday we've got off. And Louise said, no, it's Wednesday. I thought it was Monday all day yesterday. I've been doing this all my life, by the way. This is not the age-appropriate brain shrinkage that accounts for other things. On Wednesday, this from Politico by Ali Grassgreen. On Wednesday, the Obama administration will begin choking off the financial lifeline of for-profit colleges whose graduates can't find well-paying jobs. And the move is likely to accelerate a wave of shutdowns for an industry taking assaults from all sides, reining in the multi-billion dollar, this is the for-profit college and trade school industry. Industry has been the administration's goal for most of President Barack Obama's term in office, fueled by complaints that for-profit colleges lure students with misleading promises and saddle them with debts they can't pay back despite their newly granted degrees. So they came up with this gainful employment rule that the colleges have to actually track their graduates, and if they don't get jobs or the kind of jobs that they should have gotten with that degree, then they don't have to pay back the loan, or they can pay back the loan more slowly. And as Politico notes, the rule upheld by a court ruling just last week and set to take effect Wednesday, that's today, will trigger the closure of 1,400 programs that together enroll 840,000 students, the department has estimated. 99% of those students attend for-profit colleges. 99%. The next time somebody tells you, you know, the government can't do anything right, nonprofits can't do anything right, the profit motive is what drives all good things, you know, just look at them like, you know, what? What planet did you come from? Are you serious? The profit motive is, you know, it's a fine thing if we're talking about making blue jeans. But when we're talking about the infrastructure of this country, and in the case of college, we're talking about the intellectual infrastructure of this country, it's a whole different thing. Boy, I've got a whole stack of other things here. We'll get to these as we continue through the day. The one thing I did promise to share with you in this link, This is over at Occupy.com right now. It was originally posted on opednews.com, Rob Call's website. Looking back on Friday the 12th, the House voted on Trade Promotion Authority, the controversial bill that gives power, you know, blah, blah, blah. It passed 219 to 211. It only needed 218 in the House. In total, $197,869,145 was given to representatives for a yes vote, whereas $23 million was given for a no vote, presumably from unions. John Boehner received $5.3 million for his yay vote, his yes vote. He was the highest paid legislator. Kevin McCarthy, the number two Republican, was paid $2.4 million for his yes vote. Paul Ryan got $2.4 million for his yes vote, was the third highest paid legislator. And Pat Tilbert came in fourth, getting $1.6 million. And it's fascinating stuff. I don't have the sources for this. That's the one thing that makes me a little itchy about this story. But I'm sure that opensecrets.org is.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And, of course, all of these politicians would say, oh, come on, any assertion that I was paid $5 million to vote in a particular way, that's called bribery. That's not what happened. They just wanted to give me that money. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Could Bernie Sanders be the next FDR? Oh, there's a bunch of other things I wanted to share with you. Police, the Guardian, top story in the Guardian today. Police killings in the United States headed for 1,100 this year, with black people twice as likely to die. Guardian investigation finds 547 people killed by law enforcement so far in 2015 as Obama's call for oversight of the police in the United States continues to go unheeded. We have police departments across this country that are completely out of control, or largely out of control. Somebody quick, do something. Amazing. Okay, as I said, it's anything goes summer. Let's pick up your calls. Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin. Hey, Dave, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for your time today. I wanted to comment on the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, to me, this is such an inconsequential issue compared to the really important ones, and it hardly rates a discussion. However, the media, along with the Christian right, has totally blown it out of proportion. By the way, I do agree with the court's decision. And first and foremost, marriage, whether there's a religious ceremony or not, is a civil legal contract between consenting adults that comes along with a lot of advantages and obligations, and
that's right.
It really has nothing to do with religious freedom.
It can have absolutely nothing to do with religion, period. They're called civil ceremonies.
Yeah. Well, I just want to add that the First Amendment clearly states that every citizen has a right to practice whatever religion they want, but it also emphasizes the separation of church and state.
Right.
In other words, the freedom.
It arguably says we're free from religion, not just.
Right, yeah. That's the Establishment Clause,
right.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing in this court decision that forces any clergy, whatever faith, to perform a marriage ceremony if they don't want to.
No, that's the straw man that Fox so-called News has been pulling out all week. But it's a lie, as is usually the case.
Right, likes to use a lot of quotes from the Bible to illustrate some of these points, but as you well know, This can work both ways. Besides, I've never seen the Bible mentioned anywhere in the Constitution.
Yeah, well, and beyond that, most of the references to marriage in the Bible, if you aggregate them, are not between one man and one woman. They're, you know, Solomon had 700 wives. His father David only had, 13 wives, something like that. The rapist gets to keep the woman as his wife. Lot was... ended up, I guess, not married. He produced children by his daughters.
Right.
There's, you know, Abraham married his sister Hagar, and she couldn't have a baby, so he sort of married her assistant Hagar, the housekeeper, and she produced the baby that you know became the lineage of allegedly the lineage of Arabs. Marriage in the Bible is very rarely one man and one woman, and almost never where the woman has equal rights with the man. You know, life has changed. You know, our society has moved forward a lot. We've evolved. We've gotten better and smarter and more competent and more compassionate. And,
Well, anyway, personally, I could care less who marries who.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't affect my life in any way, shape, or form. It seems to me just another hot-button issue that's going to be pounded to death.
Yeah.
Well, the really important things get ignored, you know.
The big meme, and I used to debate these guys, you know, for years on this program, was that if gay marriage passes, then straight marriages will start to disintegrate. And my point was the only straight marriages that will start to disintegrate if gay marriage is passed are the straight marriages like perhaps Larry Craig's, where, you know, the former senator who was busted having sex with guys in the men's room in Minneapolis, where you have apparently a sham marriage, or, you know, either he's bisexual or he's gay and his wife and he just, you know, don't have, you know, they're good friends, but they don't have sex or something. And yeah, those kind of marriages, you know, gay men who are in a phony marriage just, you know, so that they can run for Senate, they may end up saying, hey, screw this. I'm going to, you know, go with the guy that I really like. But I mean, that those are few and far between, and they're going to be happier. It's something we should celebrate.
Well, a lot of 50% of marriages don't last anyway.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And this might add 1% to it for the people who are, you know, the horribly deeply closeted, or maybe not. You know, they might have just reached a homeostasis, a balance, where, you know, they're just going to keep on going. And I'm, you know, I think of you know, one politician in particular who's in the Republican side of the Senate, where, you know, everybody just kind of accepts there's something strange, but yeah, so what, you know? And I think that's a fine thing. Dave, thank you for the call. Joe in Wilmette, Illinois. Hey, Joe Roosevelt.
Yes, hi. I did want your opinion on something I picked up in the Roosevelt documentary that I was re-watching. I also want to plug a couple other recent documentaries that are excellent. One is called 1971, and it's about the anti-war demonstrators that masterminded the burglary of a satellite FBI office.
Right.
Stole all the files, were never caught, leaked them to the media, and that ended up exposing all the illegal spying the FBI was doing by
right.
them being able to take these files. The other documentary is called The Day the 60s Died, and it shows some great footage of Nixon announcing the war in Cambodia, and that leading to the Kent State Massacre.
Yep.
And they showed footage of the soldiers that are still alive and some of their footage of them going into Cambodia at that time. It's a
wow.
really good documentary.
Wow. Where are all these documentaries to be found?
You can just get them online, do a search for The Day the 60s
Died. So they're on basically YouTube now or History Channel? Or
PBS.
PBS, okay.
They're just fabulous.
So what did you learn from the Roosevelt documentary that you wanted to share with us?
There was a very telling moment. At the beginning of World War II, Roosevelt gave the industry carte blanche and a blank check to build our military machines. And including Ford Motor Company had a 67-acre indoor facility in Ypsilanti, Michigan, that was turning out the massive B-72 Flying Fortresses at about one plane an hour
right.
on an assembly line. And during that time, there were zero productions of cars.
Right.
And what they stated very briefly was that Roosevelt, who spent his career going toe-to-toe against the industrial leaders of this country, turned around and went into business with them to crank out these machinery we needed to fight World War II. And it just occurred to me, it seems like that might have really derailed all kinds of progress that labor had. Now, certainly World War II helped labor in terms of gaining employment, union representation, and
yeah.
benefit increase.
Joe, let me share with you what Dwight Eisenhower identified this. He said, you know, before World War II, we had no permanent arms industry. We had no military-industrial complex of consequence, and we converted, as you point out, civilian to that, and then that metastasized and took on a life of its own. Here's the opening of Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address in 1961, his last speech to the nation as president. John Kennedy was coming in a couple of days later as, you know, to be inaugurated. And here's, I think very elegantly, if it's the clip I think it is, this is Eisenhower talking about this. Check this out.
or military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society.
Now, this is the beginning, Joe, of the speech that he ends up with, where he basically says, beware of the military-industrial complex. And most people don't know about the beginning. But he's saying basically what you're saying, that this was the outgrowth of World War II. And actually, you could say the Korean War as well. Your thoughts?
I absolutely agree. It just seems that what happened was kind of a missing link that Roosevelt started in establishing the, you know, separation of labor and the powers of industry. And World War II kind of derailed it and made industry another branch of our government.
Right.
That it seems that we've never been able to regain that lost ground.
Right, and the amazing thing is that most people today, if you were to ask, you know, most people today, at least under 50 or 60 years old, well, even that, you know, if you were to ask most people today, you know, have we always had a permanent arms industry in the United States, they'd say, sure, all the way back to George Washington, they were making cannons. Well, yeah, somebody was, but nothing like now. I mean, Dwight Eisenhower said, we have never before had this. Makers of plowshares could make swords, and that's what we did in World War II. Fascinating, Joe. Thanks for the tip on the documentary, and thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls on Anything Goes Summer right after this. Stars Your Mail coming up at the top of the hour. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and David watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Mobile, Alabama. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'll tell you what. The two previous callers are really right in line. I've been a Republican for, well, I'm 67. I voted Republican except once. That was Jimmy Carter. Until next time, I'm going to vote for Bernie Sanders. I have a comment to make, and then I want to ask you a question. Is that all right?
Sure.
Okay. Now the question I ask is not is. I'm asking out of ignorance because I really do not know. I heard you yesterday when you explained the difference between a trade deficit and trade debt and national debt. I have never, ever heard that before. That was an eye-opener to me.
Yeah, good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now my question is, and you have to understand, I don't know if you're familiar with the case Strasser versus Strange, the gay couple in Alabama that overturned the state law against gay marriage in Alabama.
No, I'm not familiar with it.
Okay. Anyways, I married that couple. And as a result of marrying that couple, I kind of coerced them into submitting a lawsuit. And I'm not an attorney, but we did it all of ourselves.
Wow.
As a result. Right, and I'm also a minister. As a result of that, man, I'll tell you, man, I was ostracized by my church. I'll tell you what, and it got me thinking. man, it really got me thinking. And for the first time in my life, I really realized, as a minister of the gospel, I was using my faith to hate.
Yeah. That's an, okay, that's
now, Mike, now, my question to you is, and like I say, I keep watching Fox News and keep watching all these other programs.
That can be dangerous.
And I know that, man. I've been doing it all my
okay.
All
so
my,
to your question,
life,
David, because we're down to about a minute and a half.
My question is, can you enumerate why and asking a person for a photo ID is racial?
Is racial?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'll explain it. It's fairly straightforward. The greatest predictor of whether or not you have a driver's license is how much money you have. Most people who have enough money buy a car and they need a driver's license in order to drive. And they have enough money to fly, so they need a driver's license for that, those kind of things. What you find is that the percentage of people in the United States who don't have a photo ID that would meet the requirements, and some of these requirements are really extreme, like in Texas. You know, if you're a student registered in the Texas school system, which means that they've already vetted the fact that not only are you a citizen, but also that you're a resident of the state. In Texas, you can't use a student ID, but you can use a concealed carry permit in Texas as your ID, which doesn't even have your picture on it. So clearly this is partisan. They know that, you know, people who carry concealed weapons are more likely to vote Republican. But it's 22% of African Americans in the United States don't have a driver's license. This includes, you know, younger people who don't yet own a car. A lot of people who live in the city. I've been living in Washington, D.C. for 5 years now, and I haven't had a car for 5 years. And you know, if I didn't use it for flying and things, I probably wouldn't have renewed my driver's license. 19% of Hispanics. Among whites, it's 8%. That's why they're doing this. I think it's locked up. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour. Yeah, my call screen software is just locked up. Comcast burp our internet again? I'm gonna quit out of it. Somebody sent me a note saying, you know, Comcast's service is so terrible in your building. Why don't you get Verizon or something? This is like an 80 or 90-year-old building, and the only kind of internet that we can get in this building is Comcast. And, you know, unfortunately, it keeps croaking on us. It's, you know, burps. It's intermittent. It comes and goes. And it's, shall we say, extremely frustrating. That's the bad news. The good news is that in August or September, we're going to be moving because the building that we're in is owned by the Heritage Foundation, and they're tearing it down to do something. And so the buildings that we're looking at, the first question we ask is, do you have multiple internet providers? Because and we'd like to kind of stay away from Comcast or Xfinity or whatever it's called, because it's just the service has been miserable. Anyhow, Carol watching Free Speech TV in Newport, Rhode Island. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hey, Tom, we love you and Bernie, and we are voting for Bernie, and we're spreading the word all over the
thank
country.
You. Yeah, spreading
all
the
right,
word is important.
Welcome. Absolutely. Spot on. Listen, I want to talk to you real quick about the Native Americans. There's a couple things I want to talk about. That gentleman, let me go back a little bit. I don't want to get winded on you. FDR, the gentleman that just called about FDR, we watched the documentaries on PBS on DirecTV. We watched the last part last night, and I'll tell you, he was one of the most greatest presidents this country has ever had, and this whole country should know about FDR. I am buying the CDs, and I'm going to send them to people.
Yeah.
All right. Another thing about gays, all right, I want to get this real quick. This is what people don't get it about the gays and people that are both ways. Scientists have found out that it's in the DNA. While the baby's being formed in the mother's uterus, it may come out a boy, but it's really a female and vice versa. And the reason why they go both ways, you know what I'm saying? Both ways?
Yeah.
They like men and women? It's because it's in the DNA.
Yeah.
And this is nobody is talking about.
It's something because we see it throughout the animal kingdom too, Carol. There are, you know, you see gay animals all the time. We had a gay duck couple that lived behind our floating home in Portland for 2 years. We called them Adam and Steve.
Right. Absolutely. I remember that. And I have to be honest with you, Tom, for years ago, I thought it was disgusting. I really did. And I ask all the gays and the bisexuals out there to forgive me because I did a lot of research. And again, I'm going to say they're born that way. And when Christians say they always tell me they choose to be that way, I explain to them about the DNA. I ask them, look it up and research it for yourself. Scientists know that they are born that way. They can't help it. One more thing about the Native American Indians. I don't want to get long-winded. I'm so sorry. There's so much I've been wanting to say these last few days. All right. The Native American Indians, they are so downtrodden. I cannot believe what this government has done for years and years. And keep doing it. And about what you said about McCain doing that. There has to be something. And when you said a coalition going, spot on, Tom. We've been thinking the same thing. We have to get a coalition going for the Native American Indians. Make a long story short, we never knew. My mother hid it from us that my father had a lot of Native American Indian in him, and my mother would call them savages every now and then in front of my father. And we're a very big family. Long story short, we found out we have a lot of Native American Indian in us. When I would get teen in the summer, people would ask me what tribe I was from. I'm not kidding.
Yeah. And Carol, you now have gone through three topics in 4 minutes, and I have to move along. But thank you very much for the call. Kyle in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Kyle.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, and you're on the air.
Okay. I just wanted to mention my experience with student loan. And you know about the Nelnet, right? How they switched everything over to the federal Nelnet.
I know a little bit about it. I'm not anywhere near an expert on it. What's your point or your question?
My point is that I filed for permanent disability through the Nelnet.
Right.
And they put on a 3-year probation. And after that 3 years, if you don't take a loan out, if you don't make any money above the poverty level, they forgive the whole thing.
Oh, interesting.
And I had just completed mine, and they forgave my whole.
So there is a student loan forgiveness program that has worked for you. That's good news, Kyle. Thanks for calling and sharing that with us. Frankly, I think we need to forgive all student loans immediately. It's only $1 trillion or a little more than. It's less than we spent in Iraq. It's less than we spent in Afghanistan. We can do that and then start providing free college to everybody in this country. We need to build our intellectual infrastructure. Rich in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, listening on SiriusXM. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, good talking to you, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to let you know, with Bernie coming up in the polls, I think they've got the Republicans all really scared. I think that's why they're ignoring him so much.
Oh, yeah. They know how to run against Hillary Clinton. They have no idea how to run against Bernie Sanders.
And one thing, I don't know if you remember Lieberman's last election some years back where they dumped their own candidate and backed Lieberman because they knew they had him bought and paid for.
Yeah, yeah, against Ned Lamont.
Watch for a lot of Republican money coming into the Democratic side to try and drown out Bernie and.
Well, I think it might already be happening. Hillary Clinton's campaign just announced what they've raised. I think it was $25 million in the first quarter, $45 million.
Yeah,
$45 million. But Bernie's raised $9 million with an average donation of $40 a person. I mean, that's pretty breathtaking.
Also to get Bernie some more exposure, even though the debates are coming up. I think Bernie will set up some of his own debates, non-sanctioned debates, and have like you as a moderator, invite the other candidates if they don't show up, ask the question, turn it into a town hall, and get as much exposure as they can get, and loan him your tagline.
Yeah, tag you're it.
This is not, that this is not a spectator sport.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, democracy. Well, and democracy is not a spectator sport. Rich, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. Dar Jamail is going to drop by. Is the human race an endangered species? Are we just a few generations away from the possibility of human extinction on this planet? Is it really that bad? Is it just climate change? Is it population? What is it? We'll talk with Dar Jamail. He's done a brilliant piece investigating this. It's available at our Truth.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
6 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dar Jamail, investigative journalist and staff writer with truthout.org, is on the line with us. Dar, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be with you.
It's always great to have you. Your research and writing your research is so in-depth and your writing is so clear. I want to strongly recommend people get over to Truthout and read your piece, Sixth Great Extinction, Mass Extinction Event Begins, 2015 on pace to become hottest year on record. That's the headline. Tell us about this.
Well, I think the title pretty much gives people, I think, the most important parts of the story. You know, I know you've been writing and reporting about this for a long time, and there's been a few others, but, you know, it's well known in the scientific community that we've definitely been on the track to be basically starting the next great mass extinction event on the planet because of the massive amount of CO2 we pumped into the atmosphere. And now we finally have a peer-reviewed scientific report that officially makes this very clear. We have indeed entered the sixth great mass extinction event in the geologic history of the planet. And that is really, really shocking news. And I think it's important that people really pause and let that sink in and think about what that really means. And then also consider the fact that the report goes on to add that the now current background rate of extinction is so high that it actually even surpasses that of the previous most intense mass extinction event, that of the Permian mass extinction event that happened 250 million years ago that wiped out over 90% of all life on Earth. And right. This report shows very clearly that we are actually way further along as far as the rate of species extinction. And the report also adds that humans are expected to be in basically the first wave of the species that we ourselves are driving extinct, and then went on to use the analogy that, you know, what we've done with how we've with overpopulation and pollution, and then of course the pumping so much CO2 into the atmosphere that it's the equivalent of sitting on a limb high up on a tree and then sawing off that limb.
Yeah, it's exactly what we're doing. Paul Ehrlich back in the 1970s published a book called The Population Bomb. And Richard Leakey in the late 80s, early 90s, published a book called The Sixth Extinction, and or a title very much like that. I'm pretty sure that was the title. And both of them, I mean, this was before the climate change information was widely known. Both of them were suggesting that the fact that it took 165,000 years for us to reach our first billion people in 1800, it took 130 years for us to reach our second billion people in 1930, took only 30 years to reach our third billion people in 1960, took only 14 years to reach our fourth billion people in 1974, 13 years to reach our fifth billion in 1987, 11 years to reach our sixth billion in 1999, and now we're on our seventh billion. That mass of human flesh on the planet, which now exceeds that of even termites, which used to be the largest single species form of flesh on the planet, we are consuming more than half of the planet's fresh water. We are consuming and destroying most of the planet's arable land, the land on which things can be grown. To what extent is this extinction that this paper is writing about comparing human population growth and stupid policies around things like, you know, in agriculture, you know, like the Pope called out GMOs and said they destroy the web of life, you know, to what extent is it calling out our masses versus calling out climate change? I mean, is climate change, would solving climate change solve this problem?
No, everything you just mentioned actually is thankfully included in the report. In fact, it does keep a very clear focus on the overpopulation factor. And actually, Paul Ehrlich is a contributor to the report. And it does focus also on things like, you know, the deforestation and the train of effects put in motion by overpopulation and how big of a contributor of the problem that is in addition to CO2 emissions. And so all of those are addressed. And that's another reason why this is such an important report. And it comes out in literally within a 10-day window of some other reports like NASA's most recent updated climate information showing that this year we are already on pace to comfortably on pace to set yet another record hot year of all time for the globe. We look around the planet, as I did in my dispatch, we see record temperatures happening everywhere. We see record heat waves, both in India and Pakistan, that together have killed several thousand people. We see massive droughts in Sao Paulo, a megacity of over 20 million people that's expected to literally run out of water in August.
Yeah, you're 5% of capacity right now.
Right, right. And then we see major water issues throughout the Southwest here. And then, of course, California, which goes without saying, is being engulfed in wildfires. We over 500,000 of acres have already burned up in the state of Alaska, with over 60 wildfires burning as we speak up there. So we just look around the globe and we see all of this anecdotal evidence. Of course, you know, and we have to toss in, none of these events can be attributed solely to climate change, but there's enough scientific data out there that showed that clearly it's all being dramatically exacerbated by CO2. And all of this is addressed in the report. And that's another reason why I think it's such an important and timely report.
Yeah, you started out with a very personal story of climbing a mountain in the Mount Adams in the Pacific Northwest. And tell us about that experience and how it's being replicated in the Himalayas, in the Andes, in the Rockies. The mountains of California, which typically glaciate during the winter or something close to it, and then distribute that water downstream during the spring, summer, and fall, and increasingly are not.
Well, I do a lot of mountain climbing, and I recently did climbs up both Mount Adams and Mount Baker, two of the larger volcanoes up here in the Pacific Northwest. And on both peaks, I went in, and first of all, on Mount Adams down in South Central Washington State, and I talked with someone at a ranger's district, and they said, look, it's like, even though you're here, it's late May, it's like late August conditions, that everything's melting out so quick. And so for that mountain, what that meant is we were able to drive up to the trailhead at 5,600 feet, which normally is a road that wouldn't have been open for, you know, 3 to 4 weeks later. But we drove straight up. It was completely dry, and we actually didn't even get on snow until a couple of thousand vertical feet up on the route. And then we went up to Mount Baker, and again, you know, we went up, and I, you know, done some investigating to figure out route information and conditions, and talk with some of the guide services who had been up there for a long time, and they said the same thing. They said, look, it's glacier travel. And there's going to be very weak or non-existent snow bridges because we're already in basically late August conditions, except that it's early May. And that's exactly what we found. And so right. Very precarious going. And, you know, all of this, I attribute it to another report in this recent dispatch that shows that, for example, in the Himalaya, an estimated, I think it's between 79 and 99% of all glaciers in the Himalaya, the highest mountain range in the world, will likely be non-existent by 2100. So we could theoretically looking at Mount Everest.
Which means that like the Ganges River will dry up.
Right, right. And think about the ramifications about this, snowpack, water availability, et cetera. But, you know, the iconic Mount Everest, the highest point on the planet, likely by 2100 will not have glaciers. And I think that says enough.
Yeah. Kilimanjaro is going quick. We have just a half a minute or so, Dar. Alaska, it's gone nuts.
Alaska, record temperatures up there in the town of Eagle, Alaska. They saw 91 degrees. It was the first time they'd seen that high of a temperature that early in the year. Records being set all over up there.
It's been warmer there than here in D.C.
That's right.
This is because the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the country and because the jet stream has been altered by global warming?
That's right.
Apparently the case. Dar Jamil. Dar, it's always great talking with you. His Twitter handle is at Dar Jamil, DarJamail. You can read his article over at truthout.org. Thanks, Dar.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Stick around. We'll be back. I got some more news for you and anything goes. Summer. Welcome back. Jill, in watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Princeton, Minnesota. What's up, Jill?
Hi, Tom. I just had to take you off the speaker.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the commentary on our global warming. Can you hear me?
Yes, just fine.
Okay, great. And also, I'm so glad MSNBC had you on. I think probably people are a little scared of Bernie, and I'm hoping that Elizabeth will run as the vice president.
Yeah, that was the one thing I wish I had mentioned last night, because they were all talking about Elizabeth Warren, and I didn't know before I got to the studio. Actually, I didn't know until I heard the first question that we were going to talk about Bernie in the context of Elizabeth Warren. I thought we were just going to talk about Bernie. And had I thought it through a little bit, even for 5 minutes, I would have slipped in a Sanders Warren 2016 would be a perfect ticket comment.
Yeah,
but perfect. I didn't.
You know, when I listen to all the news, the so-called news, including, my feelings aren't very good about the state of our world.
Yeah.
But when I hear the name Bernie Sanders, I feel so much better.
Yeah.
And I think he can win the presidency. I think he can win it only with the people. And spreading out that word is so incredibly important.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree.
I have a huge banner on my window painted, and it's crude looking, but I'm ordering stickers and banners and
that's great.
A T-shirt.
Yeah, they've got a whole pile of stuff over at BernieSanders.com right now.
Yeah.
The store they've
set up.
So
in contrast, when I hear the word Hillary, it's concern, but I'll vote for her. And when I hear Republican candidates, not so much.
Yeah, the Republicans are flat out nuts, and they're going to do as much damage to this country as they possibly can on behalf of transnational corporations and billionaires. There's just, I mean, we can just set that one aside. Hillary Clinton is...
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thank you very much, Jill, for the call. Hillary Clinton is taking the more traditional approach post-Reagan, post-Buckley, basically. The Supreme Court said money is unlimited in politics, and so, you know, she's going for the big money and, you know, has raised $45 million. I understand that. That's what you have to do if she's going to seriously take on Jeb Bush or Donald Trump or anybody who's polling number two right now. In the latest Michigan poll, as Donald Trump was tied for number two with Scott Walker and somebody else, I forget who, and Bush was only 1 point ahead. He was at 14% versus 13. But in any case, if Hillary Clinton is going to take these guys on, and she's going to do it in the classic way, in the way that Bill Clinton ran for president, the way that Barack Obama ran for president, she's going to need the help and the money of Wall Street, and, among others, and major industries. And there's a certain amount of baggage that comes with that that, you know, makes it difficult. On the other hand, I think that while President Obama has absolutely failed to bite the hand that fed him, I mean, Wall Street was strongly behind him in 2008. And he never sent any banksters to jail. On the other hand, he did push through the new commodity trading thing. He pushed through several of Elizabeth Warren's, the Consumer Protection Financial Protection Bureau. I mean, he's done some good stuff that's really kind of PO'd Wall Street to the point that they didn't so much support him when he ran for re-election. So, I think Democrats could be redeemed. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dion in Odessa, Texas. Hey, Dion, what's on your mind?
Hey, would you mind letting it know? I don't know how many people you actually get a chance to talk to that have ever been around these people that are that far up there, but if you ever have somebody who, and I can't tell you where, what I was doing, because it would give away and I would end up being fired over it. But these people, whenever they go to talking about climate change and things like that, and they come up in their little conversations, these wealthy people, they have each other and they let them know each time to reassure themselves that it can all be reversed.
Right.
And fixed. That's why they keep going at it, Tom. That's why they keep playing it, because they're all under the impression to hold themselves up, and they're not going to realize it until they're out of gas, the brakes are gone, and it's headed downhill.
Yeah, it's a religion, Dion, and it's a salvationistic religion, which, you know, suggests that if you that you will be saved by some external force if only the right things are done. And in the case of climate change, you will be saved by the external force. The external force is technology. That we will figure out a technology that will scrub that carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere and put the planet back together. And, yeah, maybe 15, 20, 30 years ago, that conversation could have been had. But now that we've passed the tipping point for an ice-free Arctic, we are going to have to deal with the fact that our climate has already changed in ways that are irreversible, that we're going to see more severe storms. You're going to see more mile-wide tornadoes across Tornado Alley. You're going to see more flooding up and down the East Coast. You're going to see more drought in the American Southwest, and it's going to start extending all the way up the West Coast of Canada into Alaska. You're going to see diseases moving north. You're going to see pests moving north. You're going to see forests dying from heat stress. You're going to see, you know, fresh water drying up, fields going away. It's not just California. It's going to, you know, this is the new world that we live in. There's 5% more moisture in the atmosphere right now, and about 20% more carbon dioxide than there was when Reagan came into office, for example. And that's what's driving all this. And, yeah, you know, we get these wild storms here in Washington, D.C. Well, I was a kid, you know, 50 years ago, we had wild storms, but, you know, nothing like this. They might take out one house or a trailer park. But now, you know, mile-wide storm that lasts for a day and a half. I mean, this is stuff out of science fiction movies.
Yeah, and they're not. The thing is, they're beginning to. I overheard, and he was kind of starting to bend and asking. He was like he wasn't really believing what he was being told, but he was wanting to lean that way.
Right.
They've got to be told ahead of time. Some scientists have got to be able to step up and say, "Look, you've already screwed something to hell and back. This won't be reversed."
Right, and what has to be said to them is there's no place on Earth where you can buy a mansion and enough guards to protect yourself from climate change, because it's not about people. It's about the planet. And, you know, I know that there's an article in Financial Times. I shared it with my audience it must have been 6-8 months ago. In fact, I think that it was the woman who wrote, she used to be a Christy Freelander, is that her name? Krista Freeland, that's right, who wrote this brilliant book about plutocrats. In fact, I think that's the title of the book. And she was writing about how there is this rush among American billionaires to buy hidey holes, basically, you know, to buy 10,000 acres in Paraguay on the side of a mountain, or buy 5,000 acres in remote Mexico, and, you know, wall it off and turn it into a compound and generate your own power with solar and, you know, grow your own food and import basically slave labor or serf labor. And I think that this is their end plan. And, you know, millions, billions of people are at risk and may well die as a consequence of the behavior of the fossil fuel industry, and we just have to call them out. They're committing genocide against the human race and against all other species on Earth, and there's a not only a practical aspect to that, there's a moral aspect as well. Dion, thanks for the call. Fascinating story. Tracy in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Tracy, you wanted to talk about Native Americans?
Yes, sir. How are you today, Mr. Tom?
I'm fine. I'm fine, Tracy. I hope you are well.
I am peachy and blessed. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I was wondering, the story I can say, my ex-husband is Native American, and we were going, in about the mid-90s, we were going to go up to seminary in Canada, and we got done, pulled over by an RCMP, and the gentleman says, "You have a tail light out. Your back tail light is out." And my ex-husband says, "No, especially, sir, no, I don't." And he grabbed his billy club and he smashed the back of our tail light. He said, "You do now."
Whoa.
And that, yeah. I mean, and I just really appreciate that. I mean, there's so many stories like that about Native Americans. And he was an attorney. And we would always get pulled over. But just thank you so much. I mean, not only are African Americans being all the terrible things to Natives as well. And I just wanted to say real quick, I am a minister. And not all of us, you know, hate gay people. I mean, you know,
yeah. Oh, United Church of Christ came out years ago in favor of you know, gay marriage and gay couples. I mean, this is, and a lot of Reformed Jewish congregations as well.
Yes. Yes.
And then you've got, on the Muslim realm, you've got Muslims for Progressive Values, MPVUSA.org is the website, and Ani Zonneveld, you know, pushing this all around the world. So it's good stuff.
My ministry is I pray for people who people don't want to be prayed for. And I pray for, you know, my colleagues. So if anybody needs it, they do.
Yeah. Yeah.
But thank you very much, Tom. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Tracy. Feel free to include me in your prayers.
I have been praying for you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I'll take all the prayers and blessings I can get. I appreciate it. Tracy, thank you for your call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Bernie has an op-ed in the Huffington Post today titled, "Why Not? Our job is not to think small, it's to think big. Why not?" Bad and the very, very doxastically ugly, the good. Pope Francis. Last week, the Pope got a lot of attention for the most recent encyclical on the environment, Laudato Si. Everyone focused on the Church's position on climate change as an issue of global inequality. The Holy Father also weighed in on GMOs in the same encyclical, writing that, quote, "The expansion of these crops has the effect of destroying the complex network of ecosystems, diminishing the diversity of production, and affecting regional economies now and in the future." He went on to call for a, quote, "broad, responsible, scientific, and social debate on the matter." What a great idea. A debate about a technology before we unleash it on the planet. The bad. Kevin Jackson. The Fox so-called news guest commentator seems genuinely confused about the right wing and left wing and what those words mean. Take a look.
First of all, let's define what is considered right-wing or left-wing, you know, terrorism or extremism. And in the case of, for example, Dylann Roof, they've just thrown him over into the right because he passed by a, you know, a right-wing building or something. I don't know how they define that. Dylann Roof is a product of the left wing. He's a product of their education system and firmly, as much as they want to blame it on the right, as far as I'm concerned, you can look at everything that he's done, and it absolutely adds up to leftism.
Right, except that he didn't say that he was inspired by his public schools, brought to him courtesy of the Democratic Party. He said he was inspired by the Council of Conservative Citizens. I think it's safe to call him a right-wing terrorist. And the very, very ugly Pete Sessions, a member of the caucus room conspiracy group. Another Republican representative has stepped up to try to polish the history of the Confederate flag. Listen to this.
What I do think is that it's just not appropriate for us to erase history and who we are. And our ancestors, I had ancestors.
Agreed.
My great-grandfather was killed at Antietam.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think he was an evil person. He was called to serve his country as he knew it at the time, and he did his duty, leaving my grandfather a baby at home.
Wonderful.
Fatherless. So this is a huge part of who we are, and the left is continually seeking in a host of different ways. It seems to me, I don't want to be, you know, too paranoid about this, but they seek to delegitimize the fabulous accomplishments of our country.
Yeah. By the way, that was Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama, not Pete Sessions, the congressman from, I think, Texas. Yeah. My apologies to Pete Sessions. And condemnation of Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions doesn't seem to realize that the Confederacy was the enemy of the United States during the Civil War. But did he just say that racist and treacherous history of the Confederacy is a part of who he is? Because that's very, very ugly. So, the Department of Justice has now come out with a report on the violence in Ferguson. And while I think anybody watching TV at the time could figure this out, that a lot of this violence was being provoked by the police rather than stopped by the police, that's basically the conclusion that the Department of Justice came to. The report found that having St. Louis County police snipers perched on top of tactical vehicles and pointing their weapons at crowds, peaceful protesters, in broad daylight was inappropriate and, quote, served only to exacerbate tensions between the protesters and the police. They noted that deploying armored vehicles when there was no, quote, danger or peril to citizens or officers, end quote, as law enforcement was found to have done at times, was seen by community members as an attempt to intimidate and threaten. They wrote, deploying dogs was an unwise idea, the report judged, as was firing tear gas without warning on protesters who had nowhere to go. The report also frowned on the practice of violating the constitutional rights of protesters by creating a, quote, vague and arbitrary rule where demonstrators were ordered to, quote, keep moving until they couldn't stand still for more than 5 seconds at a time. Additionally, the report found that the policies made it difficult or impossible to lodge complaints about officer conduct and that there was a lack of confidence in the compliance process. In other words, we had a police riot, just like, you know, 1986 at the Chicago Convention. It was a police riot. It was Mayor Daley's police there and then at that time, but this time it was the Ferguson police. And the here's the poll from Michigan. I just got to share this with you. Scott Walker's polling 15%. Tied for second, Donald Trump, Jeb Bush, and Ben Carson, all at 14%. Marco Rubio, 9%. Mike Huckabee, 8%. Chris Christie, 5%. Ted Cruz, 5%. Rand Paul, 4%. Carly Fiorina, 3%. John Kasich, 2%. Ricky Santorum, 2%. Lindsey Graham, 1%. Rick Perry, 1%. Bobby Jindal and George Pataki are tied at 0. And someone else got 2% of the vote. Seriously, it's if it wasn't so serious, I would think it was funny. Anyway, Cliff in Canyon Country, California. Hey, Cliff, thanks for watching. What's up?
Hey, Tom, great job last night.
Thank you.
I called Danielle before Dar Jamal came on, so I don't want to be redundant, but I just want to voice my opinion on the state of the planet and, you know, how disheartening it is what's going on. This mass extraction is leading to mass extinction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all for the mighty dollar. You
yep.
know, these various energy companies, they're just destroying the only planet we have solely for profit. No foresight, just, you know, reap as much profit as soon as possible. And, you know, with this corporate takeover of the world, I wish I could be more optimistic about the future, but, you know, it's pretty difficult. You know, Tom, you know, I'm not a religious person, but I would say nature is my religion. You know, watching a hawk soar in the air, watching a deer or a bear on a trail while I'm hiking at the Great Sequoia National Park. To me, that's a spiritual experience, and I'd like to be able to continue my religion, you know, and for the next generations of people who feel the same way I do.
Right.
But I would like to commend you and Leonardo DiCaprio and everyone involved on your Green World Rising videos. They're excellent, excellent work, very powerful, and I wish everybody could watch them.
Well, thank you. And people can find that at greenworldrising.org. And I would start, the video I'd start with is called Last Hours. And,
yeah,
you know, and share it with as many people
as you can. What's the last one? Restoration?
Restoration, yeah.
Yeah, it's excellent. Really, really well done.
Yeah, things that we can do to put things back together. Thank you, Cliff. Thank you for your kind words. And yeah, I think your mass extraction is leading to mass extinction it summarizes it brilliantly. And it's time to stop pulling carbon out of the ground and throwing it into the air. And it's time to start capturing sunlight and turning it into electricity. I mean, we can do this. We can do this. We have the technology. It's actually, if you take away the subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, wind and solar are actually cheaper right now than fossil fuels, at least in most parts of the world. Cliff, thank you very much for the call. Tim in Whitewater, Wisconsin. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thank you for taking my call. Mass extinction, everything else pales in comparison to that. But today I will talk about what I know about as a gay man and as a person that grew up in fundamentalist family, and that's the concept of religious freedom and what last Friday's decision did to religious freedom. In my opinion, the judges on Friday expanded religious freedom for the United States. Up until Friday, thousands of churches were told that they were not allowed to marry gay couples or lesbian couples under the laws of the United States, under the laws of various states. On Friday, that stopped, and those churches, for the first time, have the freedom to do what they believe is the right thing to do based on their religious beliefs.
Right.
Churches, synagogues, other religious organizations. So in spite of the right's claim that this is removing religious freedom, this is actually expanding religious freedom. And honestly, nobody's going to force pastors to marry gay couples against their will.
No, nobody can. I mean, that's
yeah. Right. It's even there in the decision.
Yeah.
You know, as long as the pastor is serving in his or her capacity as a pastor, that's
right. We allow religions to discriminate within certain reasonable boundaries in this country, and it's not an unreasonable thing, you know, to say that the Catholic Church can say, you know, if you're Protestant, well, we're not going to marry you here. You know, we have our you know, this is our club.
Right.
They can't say if you're black, we're not going to marry you here. You know, but they can say, and you know, and now arguably, well, they can still say if you're gay, we can't marry you here. I think the next step, Tim, is I don't want to force churches necessarily to. I think it would be unnecessarily contentious. And I think that this thing is something that's going to, you know, within a generation, just be looked back at the same way we look at Loving v. Virginia, you know, where in the 1960s, right, the court said black people and white people could marry each other. But that said, I think that the next step has to be looking at civil rights for gay, lesbian, transgendered people. Non-employment discrimination, housing discrimination.
Right.
You know, right. There are some serious issues that we have laws to protect people for, that those laws need to be extended to gay people. Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening on Sirius and for calling in. I absolutely agree with you. I think religious freedom was expanded by the Supreme Court last week, not contracted. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, anything goes summer. Bob Ney will be with us in about 5 minutes. Stick around. And welcome back. Let's see here. Louise watching Free Speech TV in, is it Tulare, California? Tulare?
Yeah. Is this Louise?
Yeah. Louise?
Yeah, hi. Earlier you brought up, oh, by the way, first of all, I wanted to thank you. This is my first time calling.
Thanks.
I want to thank you for what you do and for doing it for as long as you've been doing it.
Sure.
It's a great service for America.
I'm having fun. So,
all right.
What's up?
I'm glad you still are. Okay, so earlier you brought up the point of whether Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders could be the next FDR, right?
Right.
And I think they are qualified. And they have the idea, well, at least Bernie Sanders has the ideas. Hillary always has trouble getting into specifics. But, yeah, I agree with everything you said yesterday on MSNBC, right, that one show, Larry
Lawrence O'Donnell show, yeah.
Lawrence O'Donnell, yeah. But I don't think it can happen for two big reasons. Number one, I think the Republicans are going to do exactly the same thing they did to Obama, which is just to be called like a ball and chain, and drag their feet on anything that Bernie or Hillary want to pass. They're not going to let them. They're not going to let them raise taxes.
Hang on just a second, Louise. Your statement is predicated on an assumption, and that assumption is that the House and Senate are both going to stay in Republican hands. If Bernie Sanders becomes president, it will be because there was a mass movement in the United States. And I think, you know, part of it is being provoked right now by the damage that 35 years of Reaganomics has done to this country. But if there's a major economic downturn between now and the primary, that will really speed it up. And if there's a major mass movement in the United States for Bernie Sanders, you're going to see a lot of independents and even a lot of Republicans flipping their votes Democratic in those districts where progressive Democrats are running. And you're going to see progressives primary challenging, particularly the Democrats who voted for Fast Track. And you know, I think that we may, it's not inconceivable in 2016, we could end up with a Democratic House, Senate, and White House. Back to you.
You think the Democrats could take over the House?
I think it's entirely possible, yes.
Well, I sure hope you're right, Tom.
That, you know, in the last election, in the last three elections, Democrats in absolute numbers, you know, Democrats got between 500,000 and 1,000,000 more votes for the House of Representatives than Republicans did. The only reason Republicans are holding the House is because of gerrymandering. That's the only reason. And I think that I think the number of vulnerable Republicans is much higher than conventional wisdom thinks. Back to you.
Well, I mean, I think that if Bernie Sanders wins, it's because the field of Republicans is just so inept and just so childish in a way, just talking about issues that nobody even really cares about except the, you know, the strong base. And so I think Bernie does have – I think Bernie's biggest challenge is to beat Hillary. And I think he's going to have to do amazing in the debates.
Yeah, I agree.
And once he gets to the – if he beats Hillary, you're right, he will win the general election. But I think all the local elections for Congress, I don't think he's going to have such a big influence because I still think the money plays a big issue in those politics – I mean, in those elections.
It does. You're right. It does, and it will. And but that said, whoever's at the top of the ticket has a huge influence in these presidential election year politics. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, you know, we'll see. I'm hoping for the best and preparing for the worst. Thanks. Thanks, Luis. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Talk media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman program. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped and reporter for the Talk Radio News Service. Congressman, how are you?
I am good, Tom. Finally, the sun is shining. So, okay.
Yeah, indeed. Although it may rain later, but yeah. So what's up? What's happening in the world?
Well, we have three international issues and then, of course, a local issue and a couple of pieces of politics. But the international is the topic of the day, which is Greece. President Obama had asked the European Commission to try to find some type of middle ground because of course, Greece's position in NATO and, you know, the importance of it. And some of the economics, although the president said it wouldn't have a completely huge effect on our own domestic economy here. But it looks like the prime minister of Greece is trying to come to some type of terms. I think the European Commission also understands that he ran on a program of non-austerity, which he didn't feel what they wanted would work for Greece. So it looks like maybe there might be some middle ground there.
Yeah, this is going to be a real interesting one to watch. I think that what the EU is trying to do is stamp out any possibility of a successful left-wing government in any of their countries. And that this is all about ideology and politics. It's not about anything practical or real. By the way, I just saw on the TV screen here, a picture of a fellow who kind of looked like a member of the Bush family standing in front of a wall that had J-E-B exclamation mark all over it. I'm assuming that means just elect Bernie.
Yeah, it's just Jeb, though. Remember,
oh, Jeb.
Please.
Yeah, okay.
It's my last name now.
Oh, okay. I thought, yeah.
If it's the B family.
Okay. Well, I prefer to think the J-E-B exclamation mark means just elect Bernie.
It might. It very well might. And the other issue, of course, is today the shingles are starting, as we call it, out on the embassies to hang the shingle like a lawyer does while the embassy name with Cuba.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's details to work out and different, you know, who owes who some money and the idea of people, the fugitives. You know, everything that's been mentioned is on the back burner to be laid out because the big news is that the embassies will function, which means people will travel, which means there'll be contact and communication between Cubans and Americans in a great way for the first time in 54 some years. Ileana Ross Latham, the congresswoman of Cuban American background, Republican from Florida, said that this is just about Obama's legacy. This does nothing. But, you know, observers who have waited quite a few years to see changes for the Cuban people feel this is going to be a pretty good move.
Yeah.
I think it is.
Yeah, I think this is going to be part of President Obama's legacy.
Yes, and the other issue of the day is Iran, because they didn't walk away from the table, just a temporary break. They're going to have a 10-day extension, and then there'll be talks. There's a lot of people that are very hopeful that something will happen. A report came out from the International Atomic Energy Agency, which says Iran has met what they wanted it to meet on its slow-level enrichment program of holding it back. So that was some promising news. And, of course, if the president gets a deal in the next 10 days, it has to go back to the House and the Senate. The Senate beat its fist down, sent the letter, Senator Cotton and his colleagues, to Iran and demanded some type of passage of a resolution. The president, of course, reminded them he could veto anything they pass and send on to him. And so they sent something that they said was, quote, a technical change, but actually it was a change that gives the president the upper hand in this entire ballgame. They would have to act within 60 days, and as we all know, it's pretty tough with the leadership there to find the restroom in 60 days on an agreement, even within their own party, Tom. So people have some hope towards some type of solution towards a non-nuclear Iran through what President Obama is doing.
Fascinating. That's good. That's good. We would all like to see that. And I know you, as a Farsi speaker, as the only member of Congress who spoke Farsi, have a particular interest in that.
Yeah, I've watched this progress under a couple of presidents, and I think that you know, it'll be a good thing. On the domestic front, I did want to mention the email dump, as they call it, with Hillary Clinton. And frankly, Tom, the emails that seem to be looked at and treated with some publicity are ones about Hillary Clinton's comment about a certain design of a rug. You know, continues to be the spicy, sexy comments about yoga classes or whatever,
right,
which really begs the question of releasing somebody's private emails that has absolutely nothing to do with Benghazi.
Yeah.
But
whatever happened to Karl Rove and George W. Bush's 5 million emails that disappeared from the GeorgeWBush.com server during the presidency?
Those are gone. Those would have been obvious dandies to have read.
I think so. Especially the pieces that referred to Don Siegelman.
Right. And, you know, I listened to the caller, of course, that was talking to you last before I came on. And very interesting on the political side in the campaign, Chris Christie's in this race. And people keep talking on the Republican side of the aisle about these candidates. And, you know, some are in maybe to hawk books or raise campaign account money. But I will tell you, if this was purely a factor of who's the most right wing, Rick Santorum or Ted Cruz would be at the top of the food chain in the polls, and they aren't.
Right.
And the reason that Trump is getting as far as he's gotten is because it's a big indicator with Chris Christie coming in and Governor Kasich of Ohio on the 21st of this month going to enter the race, then Scott Walker, is the fact that Jeb Bush is in severe trouble.
And, well, I think there's another piece to that, Bob. I think that Donald Trump is saying our trade policies suck. And everybody in America, I think, has figured that out now. I mean, Ross Perot got 20% of the vote saying that in 1992.
Right. And Pat Buchanan took the positions of the trade, and there have been people that have spoken out. I mean, a lot of people went along in the Congress, like Lemmings, you know, with John Boehner, but that was a monetary, you know, if you just look at the money trail, the amount of money that they received for that bill from the PAC that was set up specifically for it and specifically raised several million dollars during the month of March.
Yeah.
But I think, yes, Trump is getting some resignation from that that thought.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think that anybody who comes out, you know, in opposition to so-called free trade, this managed corporate trade, is going to go a long way. And I think it's one of the things that's really catching Bernie on fire as well. Bob Nay, with the Talk Radio News Service, author of Sideswipe. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This
is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's define some terms, first of all. A union is a democratic institution that exists typically within a workplace. Its leadership is elected by a majority of its membership. Its policies are determined by a majority of its membership. And it can cease to exist if 51% of its members say that we want this union decertified. The union bargains on behalf of the workers with the employer and represents the workers and is required by law, in fact, to have attorneys represent the lawyers in any disputes with individual, like, you know, bad bosses kind of things. And the union charges dues for that, or if people choose not to be a member, they charge a fee because they are required by law to represent every single person who is, in this case, a California teacher. Unions are also the principal supporters of the Democratic Party, the largest supporters, whereas it's corporations and billionaires who are the principal supporters of the Republican Party, which I think explains why Ronald Reagan, when he came into office and we had almost a third of the American workforce unionized, started his war on organized labor. That war continues now in California. And Tim Sandifer is the principal attorney with PFL's, the Pacific Legal Foundation's national headquarters, the website PacificLegal.org, a conservative, what, think tank, would you call
it,
Tim?
We like to call ourselves an action tank. We don't write policy reports. We sue the government.
Right. So why do you hate teachers?
Yeah, well, because I hate children, right? No, the reason
is... It's a serious question.
Well, it's not a fair question, because what we're talking about is defending the rights of teachers who don't want to be forced to subsidize union political activities with which they disagree.
By law, they're not forced to. By law, they can opt out.
That's right, but the rule should
not be an opt-out. Why not just leave it the way it is?
In requirement. So imagine, for example, that there was a law that said, I'm going to force you to put a Republican candidate for president bumper sticker on your car and charge you for that unless you opt out. Well, that wouldn't be fair, even if we're talking about just a quarter.
But that's not what we're talking about.
People's freedom of speech that way.
That's not what we're talking about. I will grant you, Tim, that I think your argument that that with regard to political activity for unions, people should be able to opt out automatically and they have to opt in or something like that, which is what you want, is probably your strongest argument. But the other argument that you're making, which is that people shouldn't have to pay these what are called agency fees. In other words, people who are getting benefits from the union but don't want to pay union dues at all, still have to pay basically a minimum agency fee. Of something that might be in the neighborhood of between $30 and $100 a month, that they shouldn't have to pay for the representation that the union is required by law to provide them. That is just naked union busting that you guys are promoting, Tim.
Well, we're talking, first of all, about public sector unions, and I want to talk to you about this seriously because I think this is somewhere where you and I actually could find common ground. Because remember that the Democratic Party has a long tradition of being skeptical of public sector unions, because what you're talking about with public sector unions is people who are benefiting, they're paid out of tax dollars, and then turning around and lobbying the government to spend more tax dollars. And all of these tax dollars come from the paychecks of working class people who are forced to pay for these employees. So a democratic society ought to be really skeptical of an institution that creates a government class whose interests are contrary to the interests of working people.
Your argument is predicated on the assumption that government employees are not workers like all the rest of us.
No,
government employees have bad bosses. Tim, let me just finish this thought if I can. The extent to which you guys say, you know, government is evil, government is horrible, I would think that if you really believe that rhetoric, that you would absolutely want any employee of government to have the strongest protections possible from that evil government. And the union, we know, is the strongest worker protection that is possible in the United States of America right now.
Well, first of all, I never said that government is evil or awful. And secondly,
people from Pacific Legal Foundation assert similar things.
The Constitution of the United States, and in particular the First Amendment, which protects a person's right not to be forced to subsidize political institutions that they disagree with. And a public sector union that engages in collective bargaining is fundamentally lobbying. There's no difference between public sector and collective bargaining.
This is not a free speech issue, Tim. These people they have a job. There's an employment contract. That employment contract was negotiated by the union. We're talking talking contract law here, not some, you know, grand abstraction that has to do with the First Amendment, which doesn't say anything about unions, by the way.
I disagree. I think when a person is forced to pay money to subsidize union political activities, that is a fundamental.
They are not forced to pay for union political activities.
That's
they
not
are
true.
What they are forced to pay for is the union representing them on their behalf in negotiations with their employer or in disputes with their employer.
Government and the negotiation consists of lobbying.
No, it consists of defending workers. That's not lobbying.
I'm sure that they perceive it that way, but we're talking about the rights of dissenters.
You're inventing a new language here. You're saying that if a union, if I'm a government employee and a union, and I have a complaint about my boss is harassing me or something, and I go to the union and I say, I want your lawyer to come in and file something against this, you're suggesting that that's lobbying?
I'm saying that when the California Teachers Association goes to the legislature and asks them to increase the government spending on government schools,
that's a completely different thing. That's the part that individual union members can opt out of paying into.
I'm talking about
being represented.
Right,
and your attempts to conflate these two are admirable, but they're wrong.
The problem with the public sector union's situation is you can't make that clean distinction like you can with private sector unions. With public sector unions, when they go to the government and lobby in behalf of more government spending for government programs that are staffed by their union members, that's a political position. There really is no way of making that distinction.
And that lobbying is
on the side of freedom of speech.
And good Republicans who think that we should have no government and to hell with Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid and no more EPA and everything else just bring all the food in from China and let them eat dirt. Republicans who are committed to that, I get it, don't want there to be unions.
Well, now, wait a minute. What I've been saying has been party line Franklin Roosevelt this entire time. That's exactly what FDR's position was in opposing public sector unions, precisely because they are fundamentally cartels that are organized against the interests of taxpayers who
actually they weren't at the time. He was concerned that they may become that, and we changed our mind on that. It was in the 60s, was it not?
During
the LBJ administration.
So what I'm saying is let's return to the true democratic faith.
No, you're not. You're not saying that at all. What you're saying is you want to destroy unions because they support Democrats, and you want to cut off the money line to the Democrats at the same time that billionaires who support everything from right-wing think tanks to right-wing politicians are on the march.
A little correction, because I agree with you that I'm trying to stop the unions, the Democratic unions' money supply, but only because that money supply is forcibly taken from the people against their will. If this were money that were voluntarily contributed to the Democratic
contract,
Party, that
Tim,
would be protected
if,
by the First Amendment.
If you work in a unionized,
taken against the will of workers from their paychecks and then given to political,
are their taxes taken against their will?
Yes, they are. And
okay, are my taxes, so are you suggesting that I should not? I disagree with George W. Bush spending $2 trillion on two stupid wars. Should I be allowed to not pay my taxes?
No, that's not what we're talking about.
My government is here to protect and defend me. My government runs the police department and the fire department.
That we're accustomed to from you progressives. What I'm talking about here is freedom of speech. If you're talking about whether the government can use taxpayer money to take a political position, the answer is no.
George W. Bush took my taxpayer dollars and used it to lie to the American people about Saddam Hussein and led us into a war that cost us $1 trillion. Why do I have to pay taxes for that?
First Amendment rights of workers. I didn't realize this was about Saddam Hussein.
Well, I guess you're... Okay, we've wandered far afield. Timothy Sandifer, principal attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. PacificLegal.org is the website. The Twitter is at Timothy Sandifer, S-A-N-D-E-F-U-R, and at Pacific Legal. Thanks a lot, Tim.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Amazing. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Professor, you are spot on. If the Greeks go back to their own currency, their dollar will not be able to match the European Union. No problem, because everybody will flood that country with respect to tourism. And if they continue building ships, give the Chinese a call. But you're spot on with it. The Greeks have more power than they realize they have. And Richard Wolff would be very, very, they would be, Richard Wolff would be very proud of them. And they are de facto agents of the anti-austerity program, which is important not only for their country, but for Spain, Portugal, and even our country around the world. So let's pray that this guy, who I believe is going to be the man of the year, I know this is July, but this guy is already the man of the year because he's standing up to power. I'm talking about the guy that's leading the Greeks right now.
Yeah, Alexis Tsipras.
That's him. If they don't back him up, he's going to step down. And that's one of the first guys I've ever seen walk away from power, other than my favorite President Johnson. I know we have some shortcomings, but I like him because he walked away from power. Yeah. This would be the second guy that's going to walk away from power, and he's doing it on principle. There aren't very many people like that. So you're spot on, Professor. They need to grow up here and do what you're suggesting. Go back to your own currency. You'll be just fine.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking my call.
Okay. Thank you, Morris. I appreciate the validation, and I agree with you. Deacon in Boulder Creek, Louisiana. Hey, Deacon, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on cable. What's up?
Well, you sent me back home, Tom. I'm in California.
Uh-huh. Did I say Boulder Creek, California?
Yeah.
And where are you?
I'm in California.
Oh, okay, great. So what's up, Deacon?
You were talking about 1983 lawsuits. The clerk wouldn't issue a license, and your remedy was to file a 1983 lawsuit against them.
Oh, a civil rights lawsuit against them, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you can't just file that lawsuit. You have to exhaust administrative remedies before the court will accept your lawsuit. That means you have to file a complaint with the clerk and then go through the appeals process, and then you take that and you go to court with your 1983 lawsuit.
No, Deacon, you can sue anybody for anything anytime you want in this country.
Tom, I filed hundreds of these damn lawsuits. If you don't exhaust administrative remedies, they will not accept the lawsuit.
I would say that when the clerk says no, I won't give it to you, you just exhausted your administrative remedies.
No, you have to go through the appeals process. You have to have proof of it.
Yeah, that's only in a context of employment. That has nothing to do with getting a marriage license.
You're wrong. You're just completely wrong, but it doesn't matter. Look, the other thing I want to say is there's a book called Every Man's Constitution, and it's the history of corporate personhood from 1805 on. It's written by a guy named Jay Graham. Do you really want to get that book and read it?
I have read Jay Graham's book. In fact, I quote his speculation about the motives of Morrison Remick Waite, and in particular Stephen Jay Field, in the 1886 Santa Clara decision. I quote him in my book on equal protection. So I'm familiar with Jay Graham.
He's too late and a dollar short. But you can talk to somebody about these lawsuits.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I might be wrong on the lawsuits. I don't know, Deacon. But Shano here, who's a law school graduate, is telling me that I'm right. And say what? Shano says that in some areas of law, you have to exhaust administrative remedies, like, for example, employment law. But getting a permit from the government, he says you don't. But who knows? I mean, it almost doesn't matter. Let's do both. Deacon, thanks for the call. And thanks for recommending Mr. Graham's writing. We'll be back. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Also helping you win the water cooler wars, or at least modeling the same for you. Alan in Glendale, California. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi, Tom. Yes, I couldn't get through to you, and then I was looking around feverishly at my house, and I finally found an old phone. So anyway, I don't believe in cosmic coincidences, and here is my comment. Last week I'm trying to wrap my head around, you know, what is the public commons? And I went, you know, I thought, and I was posting things, you know, about climate change and its dangers on the internet. And sometimes I just didn't get a signal, or, you know, people wouldn't comment back, people who would normally comment back. And then it came to me, the public commons in the United States today is the world of sports. It's not the U.S. Congress. So here's my suggestion. Everyone who loves sports, and there's millions across the country, if they love their, write your favorite athlete, male and female, and urge them to support the planet. If we are beginning to die, let's go to those people who have, who are the highest profile people in the world.
Yeah.
Or in this country, and it's not politicians.
Well, it's the same
it's
thing with
athletes.
It's the same thing with movie stars, although I can tell you,
yeah,
you know,
but
we did.
With movie stars, Tom, that people already, they have a preconceived notion of like sort of left wing Hollywood.
Right.
Where I don't think athletes from my, what I watch and stuff, I've always loved sport, they don't have an agenda. So if they were, if they began to speak out about global warming and its dangers to the planet, I think people would listen because I think they go, man, I've never heard of an athlete really having a political agenda.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting idea, Alan. With regard to defining the public commons, I'm not sure that sports – well, actually, I guess, you know, national sports, when you've got national teams, you know, Germany goes up against Brazil, you know, that kind of thing. If you have stadiums that are owned by the country and teams that are funded by the country, then that is part of the national commons. But the word commons comes from the word common ownership, or from the phrase common ownership. You know, the Boston Commons back in the 1770s was that part of Boston, and for 100 years before that, was that part of Boston where anybody could graze their sheep or their cattle. You know, eventually there were too many people and it became a park, but that, you know, so the commons are the things that we either must own collectively, like, for example, the air we breathe, or things that we should own collectively because they are natural monopolies. For example, the water that comes into our home, the electricity that comes into our home, the sewage that goes out of our home. And then there's, you know, a lot of the public infrastructure, which is the commons, you know, our highways, our rails, our, I would say, our primary internet systems. And, you know, these are the areas that I just don't think, and our healthcare system. I just don't think that having the principal motivator in these areas be the profit motive is a useful or constructive thing. But
Tom.
Yeah.
I respectively disagree with you.
Go for it.
When we talk in Los Angeles, we say our Los Angeles Dodgers,
right,
or our Los Angeles Lakers. And even though maybe a billionaire, like, you know, it's a mutual, I mean,
yeah,
it's like a hedge fund guys own the Dodgers now.
Right.
But it's still, and out here, you know, they've stopped showing Dodger games because of a money dispute between cable companies. And people are furious out here. I see people calling in on radios, and they're furious. They're not furious about race relations or health care or whatever. I mean, they have concerns, obviously, but you don't hear it. So I think I kind of respectfully disagree that sport isn't like part, at least part of the public commons, because people consider where it's Boston, New York, L.A., the middle of the country.
Well, these billionaires are getting us to pay for their stadiums, Alan.
They consider their team as part of their city.
Yeah, these billionaires are getting us, the taxpayers, to pay for their stadiums. So I think that you could claim that they are part of the commons.
No, I think it goes beyond that because even that, all of what you're saying is true, I still think people believe, they know they don't own the team,
right,
but they take like the civic pride and supporting their teams.
Yeah.
And athletes are these great heroes, kind of like almost mythological Greek gods.
Well, they're substitutes for warriors.
Why don't we try to contact them?
Alan, they're substitutes for warriors. Sports is war in disguise. It's friendly war. And in fact, that's where the Iroquois ended up. You know, the thing that Ben Franklin was so amazed by was that they, in order to settle disputes among the five tribes of the Iroquois Confederacy, they had 3-day-long lacrosse games. And
right.
It wasn't warfare. It was sport that they used to settle disputes. I think there's something, you know, this primal about that.
Here's my take on that, Tom. If we take in the notion of Hegelian, you know, dialectics, if there's no war, then there's no peace. If there's no, you take a hammer, right, and you can either build a house or you can, you know, kill someone, club them on the head. So I would kind of take that view, and I will reject the Darwinistic reductionist viewpoint of the universe. I think that the American Indian, Carl Jung, some religions in the world, you know, embrace religion. I think because some of those people have tapped into this, you know, whatever it is, force.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, and I would really say the American Indian because, you know, they were the first people here.
Yeah. And they're still here, by the way.
They had that, like, spirit. The spirit world is very important.
Yeah.
You know, in, like, almost all cultures, they have, like, an apocalyptic, you know, Armageddon. So if this is going to be ours, then we need those people that have tapped into this spirit world to stand up and go, you know what? We're mad as hell, and we're not going to take it anymore, like Howard Beale and the movie Network.
Yeah, and if we're going to do that, it would be a good time to change the name of the Washington team. And was it Dan Snyder is his name, the guy who owns it? Yeah, I think that's his name. Tell Mr. Snyder to get with the program. Alan, thanks for the call. Interesting thought. Let me chew on that for a little bit. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
I never thought that we would be discussing dialectics in the context of Hegel on this program. I'm impressed. Not Chuck, the philosopher. Talk media for the sane among us. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. It's a joke. Scott in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
Good. How are you? My God, I got on.
Yep. What's up?
That's exciting.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was going to. You've been bringing up unions and stuff for the past few days, and I just wanted to give you a little bit of my experience in what unions are, or at least the construction unions are like now.
Okay.
It's become a dog-eat-dog world because jobs are so hard to come by, especially in the union realm, that union members don't stand up for anybody anymore other than themselves. It used to be, my father was a member of the same union, and when he was in the union in younger days, people would stand up for each other.
Right.
And now it is so stab in the back, I've got mine, screw you, that it's a big, you know, big deal. As long as you toe the company line, you keep your job. If you don't toe the company line, then
or the union line in this case, Scott. Scott, this is exactly what Reaganism was supposed to produce. We had in 1980, we had a very tight labor market here in the United States. There were, you know, people didn't, when they graduated from high school or from college, it wasn't will I get a job, it was which job am I going to take. Right? There was a dearth of proliferation. There was a lot of opportunity. There were a lot of jobs. We still made things in the United States. We were the largest worldwide. We were the largest exporter of manufactured goods in the world in 1980, 1981, when Ronald Reagan came into office. 8 years later, by the time he left, we were no longer the world's largest manufacturer of imported goods. This in part because of granting China permanent normal trade relations and dropping tariffs with regard to them. But the war against unions has been twofold. One, part of it you heard in my debate with the fellow from the Pacific Legal Foundation who wants to basically say that, you know, anybody who doesn't want to pay a union due, even though the union is providing them with services and is required to by law, doesn't have to pay them. So it's like getting the money away from the unions. And then the second is loosening the labor markets. This is in 1997, Alan Greenspan, who was at that time the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, told the Wall Street Journal, an essential part of my job is to maintain a certain minimum necessary level of worker insecurity. In other words, every time the economy would heat up a little bit and you would have what Greenspan referred to as wage inflation. In other words, there's more jobs looking for workers than there are workers looking for jobs. And so employers start bidding against each other and it raises the cost of labor. And this is historically how it was in the United States. It's certainly how it was from the 30s until 1980. then in that kind of a tight labor market, it's, you know, unions will flourish because, you know, the workers are not, you know, fighting each other. They're fighting the employer. And what the Republicans did is they said, you know, these unions are the major funder of the Democratic Party. We want to cut off the Democratic Party's money. We've got the billionaires and the transnational corporations. They will fund the Republican Party, you know, forever and ultimately take control of the country. But we've got to get these pesky unions out of the way. And the two ways that they chose to do it, and they've been very successful, Reagan in 1986, and apropos of your construction industry, Scott, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. In 1986, when Reagan signed his amnesty deal for people who had come to the United States without documentation and instantly 5 million people became citizens, largely from Mexico, but also from a number of other South American countries and some even European countries and whatnot. When Reagan signed that deal, he also stopped enforcing the law that would put employers in jail if they hired non-union labor. And no president since Reagan has enforced that law, although I believe, I'm quite sure that law is still on the books. In fact, I think it was part of the 1986 reforms. But the executive branch has the choice. Do we enforce the law against the people who came here from Mexico looking for work? Or do we enforce the law against the people who advertised in a Mexican newspaper, come on up to Kenosha, Wisconsin, we got a factory job for you? And the Reagan administration decided we're not going to prosecute those employers who are literally soliciting. I mean, they're publishing newspapers in Mexico with job offers and job opportunities in the United States. And so as a consequence of this, we created this giant magnet. And, you know, well over 10 million people said, cool, jobs, and nobody's going to prosecute, you know, the employer, and nobody's going to prosecute me. I'll go, you know, sure. And the sad dysfunctional thing is that now the right is not only using this to destroy unions because the labor market has become so loose. There are more people than there are jobs now, people looking for jobs. And so you're right. It's dog eat dog. You know, everybody's trying to survive. But also the right is now able to say, as they used to say about black people, and they used to say it explicitly about black people up until the mid-60s when it became unacceptable, you know, they want your job, right? And now they're saying that about brown people, you know, people, Hispanic immigrants. So anyway, they want your job. And when really what happened was the Republicans shipped those jobs to China. And so that, in my opinion, is what's going on. Does that make any sense to you, Scott?
Well, yes, it does. But I'm just talking about the people, Americans.
Yeah, I agree. You know, within the union. And you know, it's because...
Within, you know, I'm a member of the IBEW Local 5.
Yeah, one of my brothers was not just a member of IBEW, but was, you know, their shop steward for some years and back in Lansing. And it used to be, before Reagan stopped enforcing the immigration laws, or stopped enforcing the employment part of the immigration laws, that the construction industry was entirely union labor. I mean, you couldn't get a job without first going through an apprenticeship and getting certified by the union. And it was a good job that you could depend on for the rest of your life. Now,
Absolutely. Now
you've got union labor competing with all this non-union labor, much of which is even non-citizen labor.
Well, it can be non-citizen, but the thing that I'm seeing since about 1992, since I got in, is the fact that it's the people that are in the union that get what they want, and they become the company people.
Yeah. Well, that's it, you know, that's unfortunate. I mean, the fact of the matter is that a union, if the members of the union are unhappy with their leadership, Scott, 51% of them can vote them out. For that matter, if they're unhappy with their union, I used to work at Clear Channel in Portland, and we decertified a union. I voted to keep them, but, you know, they also have a right-wing talk show there. And I got outvoted, and they kicked the union, SAG they kicked them out of the radio station. You know, people...
We never know what the results are. We don't nominate people. We just vote on people.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way our union runs.
Well, and it should be more transparent. You know, Scott, I'm going to move along. Thank you for the call. It should be more transparent. Tom in Alma, Michigan, you wanted to talk about unions.
Yeah, Tom, what I wanted to talk about was about the largest union, which is the Chamber of Commerce.
and they get to do all of these things, and nobody vilifies them, but they do the same things that any other union does.
Right. They charge fees. They represent their members. They lobby.
They donate to all kinds of political parties.
Yep.
Why doesn't anybody talk about that being a union?
Well, because they don't represent working people. This was the whole idea of creating unions back in the 1930s. You know, Franklin Roosevelt, others, actually Frances Perkins, I think, was, you know, our first Secretary of Labor, female Secretary of Labor. She was Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of Labor. She was really the one who invented the New Deal. There's a book out, a biography of her, that's just a mind-boggling read and a brilliant insight into the early years of Franklin Roosevelt's administration. And her point was that if capital is able to collectively to pull itself together collectively and negotiate against or with labor, the labor, in other words, capital being, you know, all the stockholders and investors and the senior management and ownership of the corporation, if they're able to do that or to even do that across corporations within an industry, then labor workers should be able to do the same thing. And that's what, and up until that point, it was not legal for workers to do that. You could form a union, but you had no legal protections. And thus, in 1935, I think it was, the National Labor Relations Act, also known as the Wagner Act, was passed, which gave private sector employees the right to unionize. And then in the 60s, LBJ gave public sector employees the right to unionize, too, because, you know, he was realizing that, you know, if you're a worker, you're a worker. It doesn't matter where whether your paycheck is coming from ExxonMobil or whether it's coming from, you know, the state of Michigan. So am I making sense, Tom?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it is a duck.
Yeah.
Chamber
yeah.
of Commerce is a union, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think by the definitions that you're using, absolutely. And I don't disagree with those definitions. The problem is that the definition at law is that a union is actually a labor union. In fact, that was the phrase that used to be used. And the whole purpose of the union was to defend and protect the workers. And but, yeah, we've had corporate unions forever. I mean, you know, John Rockefeller creating the Standard Oil Trust and then colluding with the railroads to charge higher prices to carry the kerosene of his competitors. I mean, it goes back. It probably goes back to the founding of the Republic, Tom. Thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. Excellent point. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So I keep seeing this guy on TV in front of these signs that say J-E-B! Exclamation mark. Is that Just Elect Bernie? I mean, Just Elect Bernie! Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Scott, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Canaan, Maine. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I'm glad you got me. I'm almost out of battery.
Oh,
man, I disagree with you so much, so many times, that sometimes I think I'm a Republican, but I'm really not. I had a question about the candidates.
Yeah.
I needed to, how do you hold the candidates responsible or, you know, for the promises they make? I know Bernie is going to yank Hillary across that center line and going to yank her hard. You know, and she's going to say what she's got to say, do what she's got to do to get elected, and then she's going to turn around and be Hillary, you know. And I hope Bernie wins, and I hope, you know, she gets yanked hard, which she's going to. But once she's in office or, you know, I know Bernie would be pretty good, but if she gets in there, how are you going to hold her accountable?
Well, that's a good.
She's going to have to make.
That's a good question, you know? Scott.
Bill Clinton. She'll turn around and do an Obama on us.
Yeah, you know, it's not just Obama. It was Bill Clinton was the first one to do this. He campaigned on a speech called the New Covenant speech. I wrote a book called Threshold, and in it I reprint a good chunk of Clinton's New Covenant speech. And it was basically FDR. He was calling for strengthening Social Security, improving our schools, the national health care system, you know, on and on and on. There's going to be a new covenant between the government and its people that will serve the people rather than just the special interests. And he won on that in 1992. And then 2 weeks before he was inaugurated, Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan and one other guy whose name I have forgotten sat him down and said, son, Larry Summers sat him down and said, son, we're going to tell you the facts of life. You might have campaigned on this, but if you govern on this, you're going to be toast. And so you know, Barack Obama campaigned as a liberal. He has governed as a moderate, and I don't like even using the word moderate. I'd say he campaigned as a liberal Democrat, and he's governed as a moderate Republican. Bill Clinton did the same, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if Hillary Clinton does the same. And the only way that I know to hold candidates accountable, the two ways that I know of, are number one, elections, but, you know, a president is in there for 4 years. So you're not going to kick him out quickly. Or number two, although you can change the composition of the House of Representatives every 2 years and the Senate every 2 years, although senators have 6-year terms, a third of them are up for election every 2 years. So number one, elections. And number two, through things like social media, which did not exist in the 90s during the Clinton administration. People were not able to go on Twitter or on Facebook and say, you know, Bill Clinton promised us free college education when he was, I don't remember the exact details of what his promises were, but he campaigned on X. And instead we got Y. And, you know, we're seriously upset about that. And I think that the blowback that Barack Obama has gotten against fast track and so-called, you know, free trade, corporate free trade, is something that, I mean, there was a blowback in 93, 95, I guess it was, whenever NAFTA was signed, maybe it was 96. There was a blowback against that, but it wasn't anything close to what, you know, this administration's experiencing now. So I think that, Scott, you go to social media, you go to Facebook and Twitter, and you go to the internet, you join groups that are activist groups. You know, yeah. So call sometime when you want to disagree with me, Scott. I would love to find out the areas where you think I'm crazy. It'd be a fascinating conversation. Thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back, Stephen, in Burbank, California. Hey, Stephen, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I liked what you said about your tax money going to subsidize death and destruction in Iraq, but that's a tricky word, subsidy, to subsidize. Your guest is complaining that the teachers are forced to give up money out of their paycheck to promote political activities against their will. Now, what I'm trying to say
is not
this.
True.
It's not true.
No, it's not true. This has been written into federal law for as long as I've been alive, I think. In fact, I think it's that this, if it wasn't part of the Wagner Act, it was part of Taft-Hartley, which says that if you're an individual union member and you disagree with the political positions that your union is taking, you can have your dues reduced. So that all of the money that the union uses to make political statements, run TV ads, support candidates, none of that money comes out of your pocket.
Oh, okay.
And that's true everywhere in this country, with every union, public or private. No, what he kept trying to do was he kept trying to say that money used for political activity, which you can opt out of, was somehow the same thing as what are called agency fees, which is where you're working in a union shop, you choose not to be a member of the union, but the union by law is required to defend you, to hire lawyers and pay those lawyers to represent or defend you in any dispute you have with your employer, and the union is required by law to negotiate on your behalf the best employment deal you can get. And so those fees, I think it's appropriate to say, yeah, if you want this good job, if you want this $60,000 a year job doing, you know, that we negotiated a good job and good pay package for you, then you have to pay for the cost of negotiating that. On the other hand, if you want to work in a non-union shop, go to work for McDonald's or Walmart.
Okay, I get that. But the bigger point is this. When we go to the supermarket to buy food, or when we buy a new car, or when we buy the new cell phone, money is coming out of our paychecks to subsidize the moneyed elite. They say, oh, these rich are so rich. Where does all that money come from? It comes from over-the-counter retail. It comes from us giving them money.
I agree.
Things that we don't want to do. And the thing is, I would like to say, well, you know what? I looked at the numbers, and my grocery bill is $38. Well, forget it. I'm only going to give you $22.13 because I don't want that other money going to the money elite to fund the campaigns that brainwash the American people into voting against their own well-being.
Yeah, you make a good point. And this is, you know, like the Walton family has been funding this campaign to do away with the estate tax, which will save them tens of billions of dollars. They have hundreds of over $100 billion to begin with. So, you know, it's not like it's going to be a big disaster for them. And other billionaires in this country have been funding these things to change it from a state tax to death tax and then do away with it. And all the Republicans are saluting that flag because they want the billionaire money. Yeah. On the other hand, the argument that against the position that you're taking, as much as I would love to totally agree with it, is that those aren't dues. Those are not, you know, when you buy groceries, you can say biology is forcing you to do it, but the supermarket is not forcing you to do it. So there's no element of force there. You must give this money to this particular company.
So what the corporate elite are saying to us is, if you don't want to play by our rules, then you can just die. You can just starve to death.
Yeah, by and large. And actually what they're doing is they're saying, we're going to buy up or drive out of business so many of our competitors. You know, every Walmart that opens, 140 local businesses on average go out of business within a decade. We're going to drive our competitors out of business. We are going to buy up our competitors. And you, the consumer, are going to end up with four or five choices for pretty much any industry, pretty much anything. Look at all these different brands, all these different candy bars, all these different magazines. They're controlled by a handful of companies, five, six, seven companies. In the media industry, I think it's 11 companies total, controlled 90% of all the media in the United States, including over 11,000 magazines, you know, fewer than 11 companies. And so, and in that way, you could argue that monopoly is forcing subsidy of monopoly. And that was the argument that Senator Sherman from Ohio made back in the 1880s when he introduced the Sherman Antitrust Act, which Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing in 1982. Stephen, thank you for the call. Alex in Cambridge, New York. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Hey, Tom. So you frequently speak out against the trade deals over the past 30 years, and I mostly agree with you that they've been bad for American workers as they aren't able to compete with cheap labor in other countries. But I also believe that raising tariffs would cause many problems. And the U.S. has engaged in significant trade liberalization since FDR. And during that time, we didn't lose manufacturing or run a trade deficit. So you talk about being fair and for pro-trade and not anti-trade. And my question is, can you maybe outline a trade deal that you'd support and the content that would be in that trade deal?
I don't think that we should be negotiating trade deals with other countries. I think that we should be sitting down and saying, what's the best thing for the United States? I wrote a book about this called Rebooting the American Dream. The first chapter quotes the 11-point plan that Alexander Hamilton laid out for George Washington. And I still think that that is what we should be doing. It's what we were doing up until the Reagan era. Number one, you put tariffs on goods that you want to manufacture in this country. If there are goods that you don't care if they're manufactured in this country or not, you give them very low tariffs. If there are critical goods, like, for example, right now, we cannot build a cruise missile without a chip from China. That's crazy. So we should put a tariff on that chip so that it becomes profitable to manufacture it in the United States rather than always having to buy it from China. And there's a whole bunch of critical industries, literally to our national defense, where China has us by the short hairs in this. And then number two is, Hamilton said, define those industries that are truly important to your country and actually provide them with subsidies. And I think we should be doing that with the clean power industry, you know, with wind and solar. Alex, and then we have a national policy, and let every other country in the world come up with their own national policy. This whole trade treaty, WTO, this is just the globalists. These are the transnational corporations saying that they want to dictate the rules of the game. And I think that's wrong. Alex, thank you for the call. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with us today. It's been a great day. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require your participation. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.